So as she said, I'll be talking about implementing an effective behavioral intervention for people living with HIV, and this is via video groups, and I'll be talking about a re-AIM evaluation. How many of you are familiar with re-AIM? Okay, some. Good. So some of you may have heard it said that it takes 17 years to get about 14% of health-related research into practice. And that's, of course, a problem. It's particularly a problem for those of us focused on HIV because we need to make the change happen now, not wait for 17 years to see it happen. So why is this such a substantial problem? Why is there such a great gap between science and practice? This slide illustrates numerous reasons. This is a slide from Larry Green and shows his leaky pipeline metaphor for this translation gap. What I'm going to talk about today is just one set of reasons within that, and that is that researchers often are failing to answer some of the critical questions that help to facilitate knowledge translation. Things like, what does it cost? What is involved? Is it sustainable? And what's necessary to make it sustainable? And is it even something that can be done in the real world? So this is the re-AIM framework. This was developed by Russ Glasgow and colleagues, and it was designed to help to decrease the amount of time that it takes to move research into practice. And it focuses on key pieces of information that's needed to make decisions about adopting and funding health-related programs. So I'll go through these just briefly. So the R in re-AIM is for reach. It has to do with looking at the number of individuals reached and the representativeness of those individuals. Efficacy or effectiveness, we won't get into the distinction between the two, but really that's just the question of impact and relatively short-term impact. A is for adoption, and that has to do with the number and representativeness of the organizations that have adopted whatever the program is, and it's also looking at those who didn't adopt and why and what are the barriers to adoption. Implementation is often focused on fidelity, but also includes what are the factors that come into play in terms of consistently implementing with fidelity. What is the time commitment associated with making it happen, and what are the costs associated with making it happen? And then maintenance is really at two different levels. So at the institutional level, it's sustainability. You know, is this something that can be institutionalized, sustained over time at an organization? And then at the individual level, it's a question of long-term impact. So if it was effective at 6 months post-intervention, is it still effective later at 12 months or further? So we investigated the re-AIM components of one evidence-based intervention, and that's healthy relationships. Some of you may be familiar with this. It's a high-impact prevention intervention developed by Seth Kalichman and colleagues. And so we took it and adapted it for use via video groups, where women would access it from community agencies, but they would each be in a private room in front of a video phone like you see here, and they would see and hear everyone else on the screen simultaneously. So we did this in a waitlist-controlled crossover randomized trial and simply among women, so we did not include men in this case. So with these video groups, the facilitators were centralized. So they were in one place using their video conferencing equipment, and then each of the participants was in another site. In one case, which is site 6 and 7, they were in the same building, but they each had their own private room sitting in front of that same place. We were able to do this in 4 counties, so I sort of clustered them a little bit based on that 1, 2, and 3 were all in the same county, but they were different organizations. 4 and 5 were each in their own county, and then 6 and 7 were in a separate county. So as per the re-AIM model, we use both quantitative and qualitative data to understand the factors affecting the re-AIM components. So we had 71 women living with HIV who were our intervention participants. We talked to staff at agencies that served people living with HIV. I'll talk about that. It was sort of a sub-study that we did afterwards to understand adoption a little bit differently. We talked to 8 staff at implementing agencies and then directors, 6 directors at agencies that had these what we call e-health stations or intervention stations. So recruitment for women living with HIV was primarily done through our clinical partners and our community-based organizations. The staff told people about it, handed out flyers. We also had some social media posting and some listserv posting. We recruited 396 people responded to our advertisements of various sorts, and a large number of those were ineligible. A large number of those were probably ineligible because they were contacting us from areas outside of those counties where we were offering the program, which was very exciting because it suggested that people were interested across a wider geographic area. So it was disappointing that we had to say no to them. But the other reason that people were ineligible is the primary outcome was sexual risk behavior, and so if women were not sexually active in the last 3 months, they were excluded. So this shows you the REAIM reach calculator. In calculating reach, there's this big question about what's the denominator? What really is your target population? And I put a number in here. I'm going to tell you where it comes from. I don't know. I wish I had a different number to put in there. So this number, 3,424, is the number of estimated women living with HIV in those 4 Florida counties where we did the study. The problem is that maybe that wasn't right because this was an intervention that was really designed for people who are engaging in sexual behavior. And so if we knew what proportion of the women were engaging in sexual behavior, we could have taken that down some and that would have been better. So we need to probably pull that from the research and do a better estimation. Then our next step in, let me see if I can use the pointer here. So here this was estimated number exposed to recruitment, and the number that we used here was the number of women in those counties estimated to be in care based on the treatment cascade information that comes from our state. So this is a bit of a guessing game where you're just you're trying to approximate and pull the best numbers. As I said, 396 responded. We had 71 who were eligible, and they all participated. So this doesn't look so good if you get down here and it says percent of reach into the target population, 2%. But this was a small pilot study, and we weren't trying to reach everybody. We were trying to reach about 70 individuals, and we got 71. The more concerning issue is, and why maybe that first number should change, is if you look down here to where it says percent excluded, it says 82. It's true, we did exclude 82%, but some of those would not have been appropriate. Not all of those women were sexually active. So there's a link down here. You can Google REAIM and find the REAIM calculator, a nice website about this if you're interested in learning more. So maybe what's more helpful here is to understand how representative our sample was of the target population. And here you can see that that there was great similarity between our sample and the target population in terms of race and ethnicity. So this, again, we pulled from the statewide data specific to those counties to help us understand how representative our sample was. Similarly, with age, we had a similar mean age across those 4 counties in terms of how it related to the population mean age. We could look at a lot of other variables and maybe should to see was there something else that might have, you know, differentiated people who participated versus who didn't, but it's hard to get some of the data we want. Like, it would be great to know, did people with less technology experience, you know, were they less likely to engage in the study? And we can't know that because we don't have statewide data on technology experience. So that becomes a challenge with the REAIM stuff. In terms of effectiveness, our primary outcome of the RCT, as I said, was sexual risk reduction. And so this slide shows that given baseline equivalence, we did find that At the six-month follow-up, we had lower rates of unprotected sexual behavior in the treatment group as opposed to the control group. But that's only part of the picture. So the REAIM framework suggests that you have to look beyond the quantitative data, and you have to ask, well, what are the unintended consequences? What is the experience of the people who have engaged in the program? What are their thoughts? What are they taking away from it? And so what we found is that this group really benefited substantially from the social support. When we asked them to tell us about their experiences, that's what they were telling us about. They weren't so much telling us about the sexual risk reduction. They were saying, this was so great, it was a safe environment, it was an opportunity to share and connect with other women, and that led us to be more comfortable with ourselves, to appreciate other women more, and to have these amazing learning opportunities where we could see how other women have dealt with these situations. So they liked the opportunity to share what they had learned, and also to learn what other people had to share as well. So that was more important to them. So we didn't learn that there were any catastrophic outcomes, but we did learn that what was really important to them about the intervention was a little bit different than what our primary outcome was. So adoption. This is about what organizations decided to adopt or not, and why. What are the barriers? Unfortunately, we did not have the data exactly for this that we would like to have as part of the RCT. We basically, you know, I picked up the phone and I talked to people I knew and I said, hey, we're going to submit this grant. We want to do this project. Would you like to be our partner? And for the most part, they said yes. And so that doesn't make for very rich information about adoption. So instead, what we did is we did a survey statewide of we talked to or had people living people who serve people living with HIV at community-based organizations and health departments throughout the state tell us if they thought their organization would be likely to adopt a video group e-health station there. What we found was that more than half said they thought their organization would be likely to adopt something like this, and they thought the benefits of it were that it was innovative, it could expand the services beyond what they could offer to people physically in person, and they liked the possibility of being affiliated with a university, and that seemed to be sort of tied to funding, the idea that if you're associated with a university, that looks good when you apply for other grants. About 24% said they thought their organization would be unlikely to adopt, and the reasons for this were more practical, so they didn't have a private space that they could, where we could do this, so that they could dedicate for the e-health station, and they didn't have the ability to have a dedicated internet line installed. We required that because I didn't want the competition within an institution, the competition for bandwidth to get in the way of what we were doing. But places like departments of health, where we have HIV clinics and they do some great things, they didn't always think it was going to work to deal with the bureaucracy in terms of trying to get a separate line installed. We were paying for it, but even with that, it still was a bureaucratic issue. So in terms of implementation, many people focus on fidelity when they talk about implementation, and we have some nice data on fidelity, but I think that's less interesting than some of the things I have to talk about because the implementation issues are so complicated here because you have the centralized facilitators and then you have the these stations out in the community. So I want to focus on that community piece. So in these agencies, they had to dedicate a private room, and then they had to have this dedicated internet line installed. And we also asked them to designate somebody as a station liaison. And that person was to ensure that the technology was working, to let us know. We didn't expect them to do the technical support side of it. You know, we would help, and then we had our technical folks who could handle that. But we needed to know if something was wrong on their end, and we needed somebody working at the organization to be able to tell us that. We also needed somebody who could greet the participants who came in, check their IDs and make sure, so we had them check IDs to make sure that people were who they said they were, and then that they the IDs matched a Ryan White letter or a prescription bottle or something, so we knew they were actually living with HIV, because we didn't want people who were not living with HIV in these groups, because that could be a real problem, as you might imagine. So we needed somebody there to do some of these things. We also had participants completing CASI interviews, so computer-based interviews, and we needed somebody to set them up on that and give them their gift cards for participation. And so that probably complicated things a lot more than what the program would be without that research piece. So it really made it hard to untangle this web of what are the challenges of implementing the research project versus what are the challenges of implementing the practice. And so that's something that, you know, we continue to try to untangle this. And it's not easy. I mean, we think that a lot of the things that they reported as challenges were primarily due to the computer-based assessments and the fact that there was a lot of, you know, tiny issues related to that and the gift cards. But it's a little hard to disentangle that. So when we talked to the agency directors and the implementing staff, they talked about scheduling as being a challenge. And that in part was because we had people coming in for assessments, and then they would reschedule, and then they would, you know, would have to deal with all that. And of course, these station liaisons have other things at the organization that they need to do. I initially envisioned this as something that a receptionist could probably do, but it didn't quite work out that way. Most of the agencies felt like the receptionists. If there was even a receptionist, the receptionists were maybe not at the level where they could handle the complexity of that. It was an issue for sure, the relative priority of the staff and the organization. I mean, this was just one of the many things that they needed to do. And so, you know, sometimes they felt like this got in the way of the other stuff that was their job, which goes to the other side of the slide where it talks about leadership and organizational climate. So it worked better in places where the leadership looked for volunteers who wanted to serve in this role and had people who were excited about it and wanted to be doing it. This is no surprise. I mean, we know this. We also didn't plan very well for, I guess, for turnover and the need to, you know, continuously train people how to do this this liaison role, and so that was a big lesson learned for us. So maintenance. We were unable to follow them for 12 months because it was a feasibility and acceptability pilot study that that only lasted several years. So we didn't have that ability, so I can't tell you about individual maintenance, but I did talk to the directors about their sense of, you know, is this something that could be sustainable? Is this something they would like to see continue at their organization? And in general, they were very enthusiastic about that possibility. They wanted to have this. They liked how this was increasing opportunities for their clients to have access to services, to engage with other women. And, they had stories that they would tell us about how the women had been impacted. But at the end, as it always does, it came down to the money. And what's, I think, particularly interesting about that is just that it's an issue of the structure of funding and how do we do that. And this is in probably my next slide, that studying sustainability of these programs is challenging. You know, you have this grant, it ends. How do we then go on and study that? And how do we study that when really the challenge is to change the funding structures? We need to incorporate some of these new systems into the funding structure. So if we want to have e-health programs that are centrally located and that different agencies can take part in or benefit from in some way, we have to change those funding structures. So studying it now is only going to tell us that they need the money. We got to figure out how to get them the money. So now we need to move, I think, to looking at how do we change the funding structures to support e-health for people living with HIV. We didn't look at costs yet because it's very hard to do that without all the documentation of how everybody's time was spent, and that's a very tricky endeavor. And we also don't have an economist on the team, but we would very much like that. So I think REAM is something that can be valuable to us as HIV-related researchers and practitioners and funders potentially, because this helps us to focus on some of the things that may need to change, or at least, you know, the benefits and costs of our intervention. So I'd encourage you all to think about using REAM or broader frameworks to evaluate your programs. My time is up. Thank you.